As of the recording of this episode, it's been 3 days since the 2023 Turkish presidential elections. Despite the hopes of the Turkish opposition, Erdogan won a third term as president after his AKP-MHP alliance had already secured a majority in parliament. What lies ahead is a question that many have on their minds. Turkey has a range of economic, political, and cultural challenges that only seem to be getting harder to solve. To talk to us today about the culture war happening in Turkey, as well as what effect Erdogan's victory might have on it, is Selim Kuru, a fellow in the Eurasia program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and an analyst at TEPAV. Selim Kuru, welcome to CSN.
Thanks, Aris, for having me.
Erdogan and other Turkish politicians often make use of the concept of the nation, using the term millet in speeches. How does the concept of the nation in Turkey relate to or differ from Western concepts of the nation? And how does this tie into the drivers of Turkish politics today?
Yeah, I don't think there is a substantial difference to Western notions of the nation. I think it's telling me perhaps that both sides of the political spectrum, both, you know, the Erdogan side as well as the opposition side, use different terms for the nation. They say one side, the opposition side, was the Millet coalition, and the other was the Cumhur coalition, which Cumhur is sort of the I think it's in late Ottoman times, Cumhuriyet. So Cumhuriyet means like republic, right? So Cumhur, to my mind, is the sort of the publica in res publica, the sort of idea of sort of embedded in the republic, which was kind of ironic to me also, because it's not a very republican coalition that they've put together, but because of the name of the office, they have to call themselves they've chosen to call themselves the Cumhur coalition. Millet has a more sort of underdog texture to it, I think. When you're talking about the people, right? You're talking about the millet, as in, you know, the people want this, the people want that. So it has a sort of ring of a sort of plebeian ring to it, right? The masses, the sort of unthinking masses almost, right? Whereas Cumhur is a little more sort of sophisticated in sound, and it's also not used very often in this context in daily speech, because Millet is used all the time. Like you might approach your friends like, hey people, right? When you're saying to your friends, hey people, you might say, hey Millet, right? Come together. Let's, you know, have this, you know, eat this pizza or something like that, right? That sort of thing. It's a more daily thing. I think that's why it might have the sound of an underdog ring to it. But yeah, both sides use it very often. And I don't think I don't know what exactly it would say about. That's profound about Turkish nationalism, but I don't think Turkish nationalism is substantially different from Western nationalism or European aspects of nationalism, beyond that it's sort of an extension of it.
In an article for The Atlantic for the 2018 presidential elections, you spoke about resentment and how that related to Erdogan's successes in politics so far. It's not a very well-known term, I think. So could you explain quickly what the term means and how it relates to Turkish politics?
Resentiment, so it's spelled a little differently from resentment, the English resentment. It's a French word, resentiment. And it means ressentiment, so literally to re-feel, to feel again, right? And it was made popular by Nietzsche, by, you know, in the 19th century, the the German thinker Friedrich Nietzsche, who picked it up from other people. So it was sort of in circulation at the time, and he picked it up. And what he ended up doing is he sort of brought a lot of his thinking around the term, and really deepened it. And in the sort of Nietzschean context, the Judeo-Christian way of valuation, and I would argue sort of the Muslim tradition is part of this, even though Nietzsche doesn't really sort of talk about it very much. Judeo-Christian morality is sort of based on this feeling, or it has its origins very much in this feeling, which makes it different from the sort of Greco-Roman past, right? Which is what Nietzsche sort of spends most of his life studying and reading, right? Because he's a philologist. And he's arguing that les sentiments, so this deep existential resentment of another, of a more powerful class, created this political pattern that became Judaism, Christianity, and then extended into modernity. And he argues that sort of modern democratic societies are also based on this sort of emotion, that the kernel of it is in this emotion, at least the evolution of that emotion, right? And I wrote that piece at the time reading work by Pankaj Mishra, who had written a book called Age of Anger, right? And he's talking there about sort of les sentiments and how there's now different les sentiments movements, right? And because also to give context, fascism is famously associated, thought of as a ressentiment movement, in a way that like educated Germans in the 20th century didn't even feel the need to explain that this was a ressentiment movement, right? That it was very intrinsic to them. When you read some of the works of sort of German analysts looking at the Nazis at the time, they use the term pretty freely. And Mishra really took it to the present, right? He's looking at Trump, he's looking at, you know, European far-right movements, he's looking at India, of course, his native country. And I sort of picked up on that because I was thinking, you know, what is the essence of the AK Party? Actually, the AK Party, but what is the essence of the sort of Erdogan movement that we're seeing in Turkey, right? This thing that's sweeping over the country, and it's a profoundly moral movement, right? Because it's an underdog movement coming to the fore, but it's also based on sort of using power, right, in a way that's not very becoming of the underdog, or it's not, to go back to some of the other themes, it's not a very Christian way of using power, right? Or it's not a very, very Judeo-Christian or Muslim way of using power, right? So it's also bursting out of the morality or the moral box in certain ways. So I was looking at that in that piece.
So just following up on that, what kind of effect does that have on AK Party voters? How do they see Turkey? Because I remember pretty well in the article you wrote about yourself and knowing growing up that there were halves to the world, and you were growing up in one half, which was maybe the have-nots, or not the ones that were on the bottom. And there was another half, which was the civilized or developed world. And knowing you weren't part of it, or not you specifically, but the kind of royal you, drove a kind of resentment and envy towards that part of the world and having to prove something. How does that translate into AK Party politics and the popularity of Erdogan specifically?
So people are intensely comparative, right? Everybody values things based on comparison and comparing ourselves with the world. The way I think that the sort of at the center of the AK Party movement, or the Erdogan movement rather specifically, is a ceaseless comparison to the Western world. It's very Occidentalist, right? And you can see that in pretty much every single news story coming out of the Erdogan sort of regime today, or every single Erdogan speech. It's intensely comparative, right? And what he's saying always is, look, you know, they used to walk all over us, and they being the West, but they can't do that anymore, right? They, you know, we're emerging now as a stronger power. You know, we used to have nothing, and now they live in squalor, right? If we go on TRT right now, we're gonna find stories about like how life in the UK, for example, or life in Europe is terrible, and that things in Turkey are improving, right? So there's always this intensely comparative aspect to life here and to this movement. And that's really at the core, right? That was always the basis of things. And even so before the AK Party, when you go back to the 1990s, say, there was this intense comparison always, but the comparison made people feel ashamed, I would say. You know, it was always, it was a deflatory sort of feeling, right? Like they out there are always going to be superior to us, and, you know, there's something wrong with us. Let's figure out what's wrong with us. And that kind of thing, that was much of the political discussion. Whereas now they've sort of flipped that on its head and said, we are great because of who we are, and they are about to lose because of who they are, right? And this kind of narrative just makes people feel much better about themselves.
One observation made by both local and foreign observers about the current election cycle is how far to the right political narratives have moved from the previous elections. However, not all of the right-wing parties look the same in Turkey. Could you tell us a bit about the differences between nationalisms in Turkey, and specifically the differences between religious nationalism and, for lack of a better word, though it's not completely correct to say this, ethnic nationalists, in terms of how they see the state and the future?
Yeah, there's still quite a bit of confusion about this, and some of it justified. I think part of it is, it used to be that when people looked at Turkish politics, especially from the outside, there was, they thought of it as Kemalists versus Islamists, okay? Kemalists versus the conservatives. And then there were the Kurds in there, and depending on where you looked at it, on your perspective, the Kurds were sort of sympathizing with the Islamists more and more, because the Kemalists were really owners of the state. They controlled things and ran things. And then there were the sort of disadvantaged groups, and they sort of stuck together. And that narrative has now been sort of debunked, I would argue, for many different reasons, right? Because the Islamists weren't as disadvantaged as that narrative suggested. It wasn't really a peripheral movement. It was actually, you know, centered in the cities and had quite a bit of access to politics as well as to means of production. So, and that movement was also pretty nationalistic if we looked at it more closely. But the thing that sometimes sort of throws us off is that there is a group in Turkey that calls itself the Nationalists, right? And they are now a different group from both of these, mostly in confusing ways. But there's also overlap on both the Kemalists and the Islamists, right? And that's the Turkists, sometimes call them pan-Turkic nationalists, sometimes just nationalists, sometimes Turkists, sometimes, you can use the Turkish words, which are ülkücü, which means idealist, right?
I just have to say, I've always loved that term, that's the one they use for themselves. It's pretty fantastic.
I wonder where that actually sort of who started that. But yeah, there's that's a movement of its own, and it's a pretty orthodox movement in the sense that they have their own sort of literature, right? They have their own ways of thinking, and they have their own hierarchy, which is organized along the sort of educational system. They call them the idealist hearts, the ülkocakları, right? And they start around middle school and high school and then university. And then, it's this sort of parallel hierarchy. And it actually, I think it educates people really well in sort of how to navigate political structures and institutions, which is part of the reason why the ülkücü are so successful at making their way up different government organizations or non-government organizations. They're pretty skilled at that. So to get back to your question, what are we talking about when we talk about nationalism? We're talking about all of these things, really. They are all nationalistic in their own specific ways. In this election, I suppose, what was important was that the sort of Islamist strand of nationalism, which is more, it has a more sort of multinational, ümmet-y type of feel to it, right? It's not as closed to other linguistic groups. It's not really closed to the Ottoman world, right? Or the post-Ottoman world, as the other ones are. Because the Kemalists are very much, okay, these are national borders. We're not changing these. Everybody within the national borders are supposed to speak Turkish, right? And they're supposed to call themselves Turkish and sort of, that's it. Even though the Kemalists have relaxed quite a bit on that front, they still have that sort of feeling. Whereas the Turkists are, sometimes they're also called Turanists, which is about sort of the pan-Turkic world in general. Some of them are about sort of integrating with the Turkic world as a whole, but they emphasize the Turkish language and Turkish culture rather than religion, I'd say. And the Islamists emphasize the sort of Islamic belonging, and especially these days, they emphasize ressentiment, I would argue. So ressentiment of the West, that's a sort of the idea of sort of historical revenge against the West and the sort of the geopolitical mission of that, which is similar to what you get with the idea of Ruskomir, so the Russian world, right? I think the Chinese are a little better adjusted on a lot of these things than some of us are, but they also seem to have that revanchist edge to them, and the Indians also. I think that it's more complicated over there, and especially in East Asia and the direction it goes to, but the Russians and Turkish sort of spheres, I think, are pretty similar in this regard.
I just wanted to ask a little bit about what's going to happen moving forward. While there's some hint of Mehmet Şimşek being part of the next Turkish cabinet, it's a rumor mill at the moment. Do you think this might move Erdogan to move towards economic orthodoxy? I mean, he's repeatedly shot down comments related to his belief in the link between interest rates and inflation. With an even more strained economic situation looking likely, what effect is this going to have on the cultural divisions that exist in Turkish society?
So there's two really broad views of who Erdogan is and what he does in the critical sphere, right? And most of the views on him are pretty favorable. Oh, the leader of the dispossessed, etc. But if you're looking at the critical sphere, there's two views. There's the liberal view, which is this guy's very tactical. You know, he's jumping from cloud to cloud. He's sort of making things work one thing at a time. He doesn't really have a strategy, he doesn't really have a long-term goal, and he can reverse policies very quickly, which is the part that's true, I think. And then there is another perspective, I think, that's sort of broadly, let's call it the non-liberal perspective. We're thinking, okay, this guy has a political strategy and he has a vision for where the country is going. And the things he does most of the time are considered and work towards a certain goal. Right? And I hope this election strengthened the second perspective, though I'm not really sure. Especially among bankers, I find they're pretty sort of narrow-minded on this. Because they're always sort of looking for little rumors, little snippets of information that can give them an edge. On this Mehmet Şimşek thing as well, they're really eager, I think, to find signs of economic orthodoxy because they really want to invest in Turkey, right? They especially spent a lot of time in London now. There's a lot of London bankers who made lots of money on Turkey in the past, right? And you know, they don't really care about democracy or the republic or anything, which I don't blame them. They're not supposed to. It's fine, whatever. But they did care about Erdogan going because they weren't really sure about whether he'd go back to the more orthodox approach, which is good for foreign investors, right? Because foreign investors made lots and lots of money on Turkey in the 2000s, especially. And that's why when there's even a tiny rumor of somebody like Mehmet Şimşek coming back, it blows up, it becomes a huge deal, and everybody wants a piece of it. And also, people can't take Erdogan seriously when he says something like, you know, high interest rates are, you know, that high interest rates are cause inflation, right? That sort of thing. I don't think it's wise to take him literally, but you should take him seriously when he says something like that because it's not sort of vaguely tactical and it's not necessarily all that religious, right? High interest rates cause unemployment and cool down growth, or put it into negative territory. And Erdogan has a particular view of the economy that's he doesn't believe in the sort of cyclical economic growth that orthodox economic theory in the liberal world would suggest, right? Can't go to Erdogan and say, listen, we're going to raise interest rates and everything's going to be awful for a while, but then things are going to get better. He doesn't do that. He says, no, we have lots of ground to cover. We have to have growth all the time, right? And So I think that was the base of his distaste for high interest rates. Then he also figured out that, you know, exporters really like this, and exporters are a big sort of very friendly group for the AK Party, which is very useful to him, right? And he sort of figured out, I think, that he can even if there's high inflation, he can sort of take care of the working class and the and by raising minimum wages or raising official wages all the time, right? Or raising the wages of retirees periodically, even though their total income goes down, they're happy that the state is still taking care of them in adverse economic conditions, right? So this is that happening. And the sort of middle class gets screwed, or especially also people working on a wage in most settings find it very disadvantageous to engage in this policy. But economic growth continues, right? Especially among exporters. And it's an export-led model. He keeps saying that. So he's happy with the economic model, okay? It also makes sense in terms of diversifying trade, right? Also, he's looking for hydrocarbons, which in the medium to long run is going to make the economy less dependent on any of these factors, especially also sanctions. So, in this sense, raising interest rates and going back to economic orthodoxy really wouldn't make sense for him, I think. I don't see any reason. He might bring back Mehmet Şimşek because it might lend a veneer of orthodoxy to an otherwise unorthodox policy, right? But aside from that, I don't see how Şimşek would change things all that much.
Lending into that question is something I wanted to ask you that I know might be impossible to answer. Actually, I know it's impossible to answer, but at least I want you to try. And that's the question of what's next for the 48% of Turkey that voted against Erdogan. How is their situation likely to look? You mentioned the middle class especially, but the wider public that publicly opposed Erdogan and wanted him gone, nearly half the country. How does Turkey look for them today, tomorrow, and so on?
Yeah, it might actually be something like 50% if you discount people living abroad. What's life going to look like? It's going to be lots of sort of knife fights within the opposition. It's going to be pretty nasty, I think. And what it's going to be like increasingly, I think it's... And the assumption was for a long time that the opposition would be left progressive, right? And then that it would have significant residue from the sort of right Kemalist past of the CHP, and then have an E-party aspect, so a sort of quasi-Turkist aspect. That was a minority, but a powerful minority that would sort of, lend credence to, that would lend credibility to the opposition's claim to govern. I think the left and progressive aspects of the opposition are probably going to decrease now. They also, because of the Kurdish movement weakening. Kurdish movement weakening in a particular sense, because the Kurdish movement has been asked to bear the burden of the Turkish left for a very long time. And in this election, they kind of felt like saying, okay, we're not having this anymore. Right? The sort of whole idea of Türkiyeleşmek, becoming of Turkey rather than Turkish, right? But having having a strong, you know, carrying the Turkish left into Ankara and having this sort of strong Turkish Kurdish political movement is really weakening, right? And that's weakening, I think, the left altogether significantly, and the progressive elements within the left, within the opposition. And especially in the second round, the way that things happened, I think, is going to resonate with opposition voters. Right. And what happened, of course, in the second round was that the opposition decided, or Kılıçdaroğlu decided, that he needed to move rightwards, and made a deal with Ümit Özdağ of the Victory Party, which is the anti-immigrant party and the strongly nationalist, pan-Turkic nationalist tradition. Right. So the opposition is moving into this strident sort of nativist position, whereas the government is, they're still stuck, I think, defending the sort of the immigration policy that they have, even though a big part of their electorate, I think, would also not support the immigration policy if they had a chance. They like Erdogan. They dislike his, I think, the immigration situation, right? But they still like him enough to vote for him. And if had the opposition gone nativist before, like much earlier, things might have been different, actually. If they had hit that button much more strongly, that would have been very difficult for Erdogan. So that, I think, will be one of the lessons of this election, and they'll go much more strongly in that direction. Which, of course, you know, the European press is sort of tutting the Turkish opposition on that, which people in the opposition have resented. I think it is what it is. That's the direction things are moving right now.
As usual, we don't end on an optimistic note, but it's been a pleasure asking you all these questions and hearing your thoughts. And also, it's been great reading some of your articles on Kulturkampf. For those who aren't subscribed yet, Selim Piro has a Substack, and he wrote that it might be a newsletter, it might be a blog, I'm not sure what it is, and I agree, but it's great. So if you're interested in reading more about Turkish politics, the way things are maybe progressing there, you have to subscribe. You definitely should. It's fantastic. So Selim, once again, thank you for being on CSM, and hope to see you again one day.
Thanks, Aris. Always a pleasure talking to you.